From the Sky News Centre at 5. There have been two arrests in connection with the News of the World phone hacking scandal. The paper's former editor Andy Coulson and ex-royal editor Clive Goodman are being questioned by police. Earlier, former Prime Minister Tony Blair described the allegations, if proven, as beyond disgusting.
I got my first mobile phone the day after I left office, right, which is a big thing. I was very excited about it. Actually, in the light of what's happened, it's just as well I did get it when I left office, but...
Meanwhile, the Deputy Prime Minister has hit out at the Press Complaints Commission for failing to act over the saga. Nick Clegg says newspapers have gained too much power to make or break people's lives. In other news, America's last ever space shuttle mission has blasted off for the International Space Station.
Five. All three engines up and burning. 2, 1, 0, and liftoff. The final liftoff of Atlantis on the shoulders of the space shuttle. America will continue the dream.
There was a scare just 31 seconds before the launch when a failure light came on and the countdown stopped, but after a brief inspection, the mission restarted. The father of a British teacher, Lindsay Hawker, has appealed for her killer to be given the strongest sentence possible. The 22-year-old was strangled and raped at Tatsuya Ichihashi's apartment in Tokyo in 2007. Addressing his trial, Lindsay's father, Bill, asked for her killer to receive the heaviest punishment available under Japanese law. British Gas says some energy bills could increase by as much as a quarter following new price hikes. Next month, 9 million households will see gas bills rise by an average of 18% and electricity by 16%. The average dual-fuel customer will pay an extra £190 a year. And Bradley Wiggins has withdrawn from the Tour de France through injury. The team Skyrider was caught up in a crash on the race's seventh stage between Le Mans and Châteauroux. That's the latest. I'm Claire Gregory.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Do you think you have a problem with cocaine or other drugs? Cocaine Anonymous can help. Visit our website, www.cauk.org.uk. We're here and we're free. Call 0800 612 0225.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Hello Bristol and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling and helping us review the news this week is Lib Dem Cabinet Member for Neighbourhoods and Lockleys Councillor Guy Portney. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, the day after the 6th anniversary of the 7/7 London bombings, we hear from a senior police intelligence analyst who believes the four alleged bombers didn't do it, and he was promptly sacked. Why does he think that? Who does he think did it? And how's the claim for unfair dismissal going? And exploring too the possibility of a context of false flag terrorism on 7/7, NATO's secret terror squads murdering European civilians and blaming it on their enemies to bounce press and politicians into war, the notorious 1980s Operation Gladio, not conspiracy theory as some would try and lull you into believing, but conspiracy fact based up by parliamentary inquiries in Italy, Belgium and Switzerland, and the murderous planners behind it all managed to keep their jobs at NATO headquarters in Brussels, and a strange death 2 weeks ago the Prime Minister's Witney Constituency Party Chair Christopher Shale at Glastonbury after he said the Tory party was voracious, crass and always on the take. I speak to a barrister who believes he was assassinated. And Gloucestershire's annual extravaganza of military air power, the Fairford Air Tattoo, is coming up next weekend, but not everyone's happy with the role of the RAF in 2011, so peace activists are preparing for an invasion of USAF Fairford. And also, as the banking crisis bites, you could become a squatter in your own home. What do Bristol squatters think of the Prime Minister's plans to criminalise squatting? That's all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 11 Celsius, wet and windy. This weekend, highs of 20 Celsius, wetter on Saturday and Sunday, but also some sunny spells breaking through. So that's, remember, wetter on Saturday than Sunday. So do your shopping on Saturday, hopefully in an indoor shopping centre. Next week, highs of 20 Celsius, a fair fair amount of sun, but also plenty of showers midweek. Next weekend, that's the 16th and 17th of July, highs of 20 Celsius and much more sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guests, and joining us is Lib Dem Cabinet Member for Neighbourhoods and Lockleys Councillor Guy Portney. Hi, Guy, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, Tony. Thanks very much.
Neighbourhoods, Cabinet Member for Neighbourhoods, what does that mean?
It's a lot of frontline services, things like pollution control, environmental health, do a lot of work with the PCSOs, also a fair bit of community cohesion work.
So what are where do we have various different individual neighbourhoods around the city?
Yeah.
I mean, like formal, for each ward, for example, you know, all our councillors get elected on a particular zone, don't they? And so that is our neighbourhoods, is it?
One of the projects that we've been bringing forward over the last couple of years, and even longer than that, to be honest, has been devolving power out from the council house to a more local framework. And part of that is the neighbourhoods agenda. It's pairing up often political wards. So mine is Hawfield and Lochlea. South meets Twinned with Henbury. You get the two St George's in together, and we get as many decisions being made at that level as we possibly can.
But one of the things you've done, for example, over the last few years as the Lib Dems, is close the housing offices, isn't you? I can remember there used to be a housing office in St Paul's. It's no longer there. Everybody has to go into a central housing office now. So, I mean, how is that good for neighbourhoods?
Right. That's part of the housing department and part of the sort of the way that we engage with the community. One of the reasons that was done was part of the way that essentially, if we're spending less time and less money on buildings scattered around the city and we centralise services, we can do more things and we can do them better. You're right, often there's a balance to be struck. But yeah, that's why that happened.
Okay, and now neighbourhood partnerships, we hear about those quite a lot, and I think for many people they're a little bit of a mystery. Can you explain what they are and what involvement you have, if any, with them?
There's sort of three-stage process to it. You've got your neighbourhood forum, which is a sort of meeting every 3 months that is just where anyone can come along, anyone can raise any problems or difficulties they're having. The police are there, different council departments are there, your local councillor should be there as well. And it's a way of sort of working through and just sort of generally improving neighbourhoods and making sure services are as responsive as they can be.
So if anyone is interested in going along to one of these forums, is it the Bristol City Council, the notorious website they have to go to? What's the best way to find out?
There should be signs all over your local neighbourhood. We have community development workers in each one of these partnerships, and their responsibility is to make sure as many people as possible know about these. So if you've got community notice boards, there'll be notices up there.
And also, if you don't, then just give the council a call. Okay, Guy. Now, do you ever feel like, you know, you're in a situation, I think, in the city council where you're constantly having to manage this kind of close down of the budget? Do you find that you're having to spend too much time on just wrestling with the cuts rather than actually being proactive as a city?
We've got a lot of proactive policies too. I mean, you just look at what we're working through at the moment with the local enterprise zone that's hopefully coming to Temple Quay. Well, almost certainly is coming to Temple Quay. That's been a fantastic new initiative that we've been able to do recently, creating new jobs in the area and in the city, and renovating essentially a part of the city that's not had enough attention paid for it for too long. And we've been able to do that in the context of having to make these savings.
But isn't a local enterprise zone the kind of thing where you're just saying to the planners, oh, just let people plan, build anything, and they don't have to pay too much business rate? So you're actually doing much proactive by having an enterprise zone. You're just sort of pulling back and saying that it's going to be a little bit easier if you want to start a business in that area, or if you want to build offices.
But I mean, that will create jobs. It's allowing, essentially, it's acting as a facilitator to make sure anyone who wants to do business in Bristol is able to create the jobs that they want to create here.
Okay, Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, he's here too. Now, Martin, this week, Portugal's been junk-rated, and the Greeks are demanding interest on the gold that was looted by the Nazis back in the Second World War. They're getting quite fed up with the Germans, who've just given them another bailout, just so that the money can go from Germany to Greece and then back to Germany again.
Well, yes, indeed. I mean, I wondered what would happen this week. It was quite clear that if the Greek Parliament had not voted for the bailout, then there would have been a crash. They voted for the bailout, but then the ratings agencies, or the ones that get reported in this country, like Standard & Poor's, were saying, yes, but they're not going to pay anyway, we're still going to mark it down as a default. Of course, the Chinese have now got their own ratings agency, and they're marking down the US as a default. It's a pack of cards about to go.
It sounds to me like almost like the war of the ratings agencies.
Well, it is a war of the ratings agencies. The Chinese have got their own Dong Gong ratings agency, I think it's called, something like that, because they're fed up with... I mean, don't forget, these ratings agencies are the ones who rated all of this junk as AAA, which when we were in the boom, and now they're supposed to be so wise and all-knowing that they've decided that Greece isn't going to pay. Actually, you don't have to be a genius to see that Greece isn't going to pay. It's pretty bloody obvious. I'm sorry, pretty obvious that they're not going to pay. And nobody's going to pay. As Keynes said in the 30s, debts that can't be paid won't be paid. And that's not a political point, it's a logical point.
So aren't they just staving off the inevitable?
They are trying to stave off the inevitable in order to keep the banking system going. So when the German taxpayer grumbles about, well, we're bailing out the Greeks again, well, in actual fact, what you're doing is bailing out your own banks.
But when the banks do finally go, it's going to be even worse, isn't it?
It's going to be absolutely horrendous. Because, of course, what should happen when the banks go is that the government is there to pick up the pieces. But with the bank bailout from 2008 onwards, the government has basically shot its bolt and given the money to the speculators on the understanding that the speculators would stop speculating. And surprise, surprise, they didn't. They just took the money and went back to the gaming table, as they were always going to do.
Ultimately, if the banking system does look like, and in this country too, if it looks like it's going to go, if we say, like, basically these banks simply go bankrupt, isn't it actually fairly simple for the government to step in and
well, it would be if they hadn't already bailed the banks out, because they would then be in a position to say, right, we'll clear away all the debris here, okay, and we're going to start again from scratch.
You're going to have to explain this to me, because I don't understand, why is it that if the bank goes bankrupt that the government has to pay any money to take it over?
Well, I mean, economists like von Hayek or von Mises and the von Mises Institute in the US have argued quite logically that the banks should have been allowed to go bust. And as a left-wing economist, I've got a great deal of sympathy with that view. I mean, basically, if any other business goes bust, you know, for example, this Derby train, Bombardier train company, if they don't get the contract, they go bust. But banks, of course, have got us in the position where if they go bust, then the whole system goes down. So they're actually in a position of having an implicit subsidy from the government always. And of course, that's always been the case. And the fact is that banks, if they're going to have an implicit subsidy from the government, have to accept government control. But the problem is that we haven't got the political power. The financial oligarchy have been bailed out by the taxpayer, and they've turned around and stuck two fingers up to us and said, we're going to do what we like and you're going to do as we say. Otherwise, we won't lend you any of your money that you've given us. We won't lend it back to you unless you do X, Y, and Z. Now, at a certain point, there is going to be a backlash. It's coming in Greece. And of course, the Greeks remember the military government from 1968 to 1972 that killed thousands of their people, put in power by MI6 and the CIA. They remember being occupied by the Germans in the war. And in fact, the Germans in 1953 were let off all of their debts by the Americans and the British as a way of getting the German economy back on its feet. So the Germans are not really in a strong position to demand full repayment from others when they were given 100% debt relief in 1953.
Okay, on to Guy Portney, Lib Dem councillor, who's on the cabinet here in Bristol. Now, obviously, this is all a little bit far away in Greece and Portugal, but do you think that your party is actually getting enough bangs for its buck with Nick Clegg up at Westminster in making sure that we are resilient if the banks do go bust?
I mean, one of the strongest positions the Lib Dems have taken in the coalition was on ensuring that the banks, two different divisions, if you like, were split. That the casino banking sort of side of things was kept definitively separate from, you know, people like you and me's own current accounts. So,
because this was a problem over in Argentina, I remember this is in the early 2000s, that when they had all their debt problems with the IMF, the IMF stepped in and actually took so much money from their banking system that pretty much everybody in the country lost their savings. Unless they'd had savings abroad, you know, you could have been saving all your life in Argentina, and suddenly that £30,000-£40,000 disappeared overnight.
I mean, that bankruptcy of banks is the difference. If you don't have a split between those two things, between, you know, devastating financial hit and total apocalypse for people. So I'm glad to see the action we're taking on that.
Okay, now we're also joined by Marina Morris, who looks this week at Can Money Bring Quality to Your Life? Yes. Hi, Marina.
Hello. Can only quantity of money bring quality in your life? Every society clings to myths by which it judges itself. We judge our success by income. A high income means a richer life, more power and influence, better choices, greater longevity and better health. The reduction of poverty is one of the United Nations 8 Millennium Goals. According to the Joseph Round 3 Foundation report, Monitoring Poverty and Social Exclusion 2010, that uses the UK government's own statistic, in 2008-09, 13 million Britons were in poverty. Of these 5.8 million, 44% of this total were in deep poverty. These household income levels, at least at third, below the poverty line, the highest proportion on record. The report's warning message is that data reflects the last government's performance and excludes the effects of cut. 2 people in 9 in the UK are in poverty, or 1 in 10 are in deep poverty. Of these old numbers, this implying prediction that the current situation and future will be worse. Poverty is a relative term. The poorest in our society are enormously wealthy by sub-Saharan African standards. How do we measure poverty? It is about more than money. The recently published Multidimensional Poverty Index takes an important new step in better understanding the measuring poverty and well-being. Poverty is about people, not numbers. The index measures deprivation in terms of health, education and living standards. This measure is not yet reflected in government statistics. On one side, lack of money makes you unhappy and increases the list of social and health problems. The question is, does money make you happy? There is a bumper sticker in the United States. The one who does this most choice wins. Rich people live longer, have happy and healthy lifestyle, are better educated and are more optimistic. Only the rate of suicide between rich and poor is similar. The rich are on the driving seats of his life and respect their personal strengths and talents. They're ambitious, have initiative and make things happen. The Easterlin paradox, however, shows as a society as GDP increases beyond a certain point, levels of satisfaction stay constant. The richer society becomes richer without increasing happiness. Once the basic needs for food, clothing and shelter are met, higher gross domestic products does not seem to make society happier. Many surveys show that happiness among citizens of various nations differs significantly. People in rich countries are generally happier than people in poor countries. All affluent countries with the highest productivity are the happiest. Within this group, the Danes and the Dutch are the top, and the French and the Italian are the bottom of this group. Swedes are happier than Americans. According to the World Happiness Index, on scale of 1 to 10, when asked how happy are you in general, UK's average score is around 7.5, Denmark's is 8.1, and Italy 6.1. A welfare system adds happiness if most people believe the system is fair. States these dreadful governments are most unhappy. Countries these authoritarian regimes, such as Belarus and Zimbabwe regimes, show low score. The nastiest regimes of all, such as North Korean and Myanmar, which is known as Burma, do not allow independence away. The former communist countries always did badly in the happiness league, but those that have made a successful transition to democracy have leapt ahead. Little Slovenia is now one of the happiest countries in the world. The happy country maintains social homogeneity and institutionalized trust between citizens. According to Tim Jackson of the Sustainable Development Commission, prosperity goes beyond material pleasure. It transcends material concerns. It resides in the quality of our lives and in the health and happiness of our families. It is present in the strength of our relationship and our trust in the community. Richard Layard, the British economist, recommends happiness, not growth, as a target of economic policy. Are we ready to change the myth that we judge ourselves? Are our basic needs only material sustenance, or do we need another compass to include both financial factors and the enjoyment of life? Next week we will explore the problems associated with old age. Now, what do the people of Bristol think about poverty and happiness? According to the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, welfare cuts introduced in 2010 budget are projected to save the Treasury more than £2 billion this year. Is it right to target cuts at the poorest in society?
No, I think they could raise the money by taxing the super rich instead of the targeting the poor. And corporation tax, that could be raised as well.
To charge the rich people, leave the poor people to like buy food and stuff.
Who should be blamed for personal poverty, and how can the poorest escape it?
It was too easy to get credit. Obviously, the responsibility is your own, but at the same time, there was a lot of convincing poor people to go into debts that they couldn't afford, in giving people loans that they could never repay. You can't have people forever on welfare. If you don't help them, there's no way that they can lift themselves out of that poverty once they're in it. The role of government to provide people with the education, provide people with the means to get themselves out of poverty, just like how we provide welfare to other countries like Africa to get themselves out of poverty. I think we should be doing that with our own young people. There's too many people sat on unemployment for too long. We need to create jobs for them and to make it worthwhile for them to go to those jobs.
Wait for the economy to get going again. Tax the rich.
Personal poverty, I'm skint at the moment, that's my fault. So it varies. It depends on whether you get paid a living wage or whether you are bad with money. People can escape poverty by education, being more sensible, and opportunities being made for them as well.
Stay in school, pay attention to your teachers, don't mess around.
Get a job. There must be jobs everywhere you look, there's jobs, even in like supermarkets or wherever, there's always something going in there, so get something, anything.
I think the government, but also people as well, like, because people are just lazy these days. Like, they don't want to get up and go for a good job and things like that, they just want to get money off the government.
It's getting out of that circle, isn't it, of all that living on the streets and selling drugs. Probably earn more money than a normal job.
Does money make you happy?
Some people say more money, more problems. But I think I could do with a bit more. I think everyone could do with it just a bit more. Apparently they've done studies, once you reach a certain amount of income, it doesn't make any difference how much more you earn. I think everyone just wants a decent life, roof over their heads, not too much stress, their kids to be happy and well fed and clothed and that. But I would say no. I would say the pursuit of money is not making people happier. People have sort of lost touch with, you know, neighbours, family, community values, and everyone's just more looking towards themselves. What can I get out of this? How does this benefit me? Rather than looking at the bigger picture, is your quality of life actually improving? Is that flat screen TV actually making you any happier? I don't think it is. Once you've reached a certain quality of life, money's just more stress.
I think if I had enough money to be comfortable, not to worry about losing my job, I think it would make a difference. Probably not make me happy, but it would make a difference in my life to be a little bit stress-free.
That was Marina Morris out on the streets this week. It's talking to you about happiness and money. Does money make you happy? I think one of the things that came across there pretty strongly was that it's all about really balancing the books. You don't have to have lots of more money than you need, but so long as you've got as much as you need to pay basic bills like rent, gas, electricity, water, these sorts of things, have a little bit spare, most people are content with that. Guy, but the trouble is we've now got the situation where, I mean, we've just heard today British Gas are raising gas and electricity prices 18 and 16%. And just flicking through here, they also raised prices back in December by about 7%, and this is a 21% increase or so over less than a year. You know, so we're getting into the situation where there's more and more people out there who simply aren't going to have disposable income, and maybe having a negative disposable income, even though they're maybe working full time.
Big problem in my ward. Big problem in my ward. I mean, one of the things I think that came out of those interviews that Marina was doing. Is it Marina? Maria?
Marina.
One of the things that came out of those interviews was that what people really want are control over the choices that they have in their own lives. That's what money is a route to. As the gentleman said, once you get beyond a certain point, it doesn't contribute anything greater to your quality of life. So it's just making sure that people have, even in the absence of you know, maybe some of that control through financial means, that we are giving as much control to people over their own lives as we can.
But the trouble is, right now, is that everyone's been told wages have got to stay the same, wage freezing, and yet we've got all these basic utilities that everybody needs to pay for. Private companies just upping and upping the prices here, massively above inflation. And there seems to be on a ratchet system. We never hear announcements that British Gas have lowered prices of gas and electricity, do we?
You don't. It's one of the reasons I'm so glad we've been able to freeze council tax for the next couple of years. I mean, I never thought I would, you know, be on this sort of show saying I'm really glad that we're not raising taxes this year. Well, you know what I mean? Like, it's a sort of right-wing idea that I wouldn't normally subscribe to myself, but it is having that much of an impact on people in my ward. I am so glad that we're not raising council tax this year.
Martin, what are your thoughts about what you heard just there? And I wonder if you're thinking what I'm thinking, which is slowly but surely, financially, more and more people are going into the red, aren't they?
Yeah, and of course, on a macroeconomic level, that means that you're moving into a crash, because that's taking effective demand out of the economy. So bashing the poor is not just unfair, it's also pretty irrational as a means of trying to deal with the problems that you're facing. There is, in fact, a diminishing marginal utility of wealth, to use the technical term, which basically means the more money you have, the less you care about it. Which is why the Liberal government of Lloyd George brought in progressive income tax. There were howls of protest from the wealthy classes when that was brought in. But of course, it's perfectly reasonable for people who've got more money to pay a higher proportion of their income in tax, because they've got more money. I mean, this is logical, really, isn't it? And they will be happy enough with 2 million rather than 3 million, for example. They will be. And at the end of the day, slashing the wages of the workforce and the benefits of those who are dependent for whatever reason is not going to cure your economic problem. I mean, Merthyr Tydfil, for example, they're going to try and force people onto smaller benefits and cut them off the dole. The only thing that keeps the shops going in Merthyr Tydfil is those benefits. And if you cut those benefits, the only jobs going in Merthyr Tydfil are in those shops, which are going to be closed because you're cutting the benefits. And the Conservatives particularly simply do not understand this argument. It's just water off a duck's back to them. There's a very influential study done recently, which Marina knows. I remember the names of the people who did it, Wilson and Pickett, as in Wilson Pickett the singer. It's called The Spirit Level, and it shows that the more equal a society is, the better its social statistics, but in terms of mental health, yeah, in terms of all sorts of things. So people are actually part of we're team animals, we're pack animals, and we actually need a sense of fairness in our lives. And it's not just an add-on, it actually leads to a healthier, happier society if there is a sense of fairness in the society. That doesn't mean complete equality, it just means fairness in the rules by which people are paid.
But Martin, right now it doesn't look like that's happening.
No.
And nothing is being changed on a macroeconomic level to change it. So it looks like at some point in the future we might end up with loads of small shops closing and end up with almost just supermarkets.
Well, what is happening is what Marx predicted many, many years ago, which is that a small group of people will end up controlling all the capital in the society. The top 1% in this country took 90-something percent of all the economic growth over the last 20 years. The bottom 10% actually lost out. Now, that is the reality of modern capitalism as managed by these kind of people.
So,
that's not to say that it couldn't be better managed, it's just been badly mismanaged.
So, Guy, your party's in the coalition government. What are you doing about this? Because this is quite a serious problem, isn't it? It looks like there's a bit of a train crash heading our way.
New Labour were very responsible for this as well.
Okay, Martin. Martin's just holding his hands up there.
Yeah.
So, Guy, what are the Lib Dems doing up at Westminster to make sure that this train crash doesn't happen?
We've got to regenerate an economy that's not based on a bubble. Part of that, one of the most useful things we can do is high-tech manufacturing, and it's one of the reasons Bristol is so well-placed to come out of this. I mean, the point that Martin might have made, I think, was that if you're producing a product that everyone needs, that needs to be accessible to the broadest possible spectrum of the population, then you benefit from economies of scale far more than you would making a niche product for the ultra wealthy. It's making sure that the next wave of economic growth is put on that broad base. It's high-tech manufacturing. It's something that everyone is going to need. More efficient products will need to be more accessible to everyone.
But this doesn't help, does it, when we see the things like the utility prices going up, gas and electricity bills. The British Gas Managing Director, Phil Bentley, said today, this is an article in today's Guardian, actually on the website today, so I imagine it's in tomorrow's Guardian, "We know there is never a good time to raise prices, but we're buying a global energy market and have to pay the market rate." Well, Maybe there is a good time to raise energy prices when there's a massive story like the closure of the News of the World dominating the news, and it's a good day to bury news like this. So what are we going to do to enable people to continue to pay their bills? It almost seems like, you know, the only option is for government to actually intervene with these energy companies and to force them to sell us affordable energy, because it seems to me they're just racking it up because they can get away with it.
You've also got to make sure that you're incentivizing green energy. I mean, that's absolutely crucial. Cheap, environmentally friendly energy is better than expensive, dirty energy.
And is it the case, Martin, do you think that maybe that we've been having cheap energy for many years, too cheap, and this is getting back to the
long-term secular trend for fossil fuels to run out, but that's not what's going on here. Most of this price rise is to do with commodity futures markets, which is not a free market at all. It's basically a bubble, another bubble. And of course, people are getting into energy, like buying futures oil contracts, because that's based on something solid, i.e. oil. But it is all manipulated. The idea that this is a free market is fantastic. And of course, most of these monopoly industries were nationalised in the 1940s, because it was quite obvious that the way to run a network system like the gas system or the electricity system is to have one person or one organisation running it, and they sell it at cost, which of course means that your manufacturers then get a cost boost and they can sell their stuff abroad cheaper. And that's why we had a mixed economy until Margaret Thatcher came to power in 1979 and dismantled it all. And we've got used to the idea that this is normal. This isn't normal. It's not normal in Norway. In Norway, they never did any of this, and they've actually got increased numbers of people employed in manufacturing industry in Norway as we speak, in the middle of the biggest global recession since World War II. How do they do it? I think it's a simple word, one word, the word I would use, socialism. And they've never given it up in Norway.
And as Marina was saying, they're much happier actually over in Scandinavia. Anyway, Guy, I want to hear from you. Why should people vote for the Liberal Democrat Party? Because you're in there, in government, and we're seeing no changes. I mean, Martin admitted that New Labour wasn't exactly perfect on these issues, but we should be seeing if your political influence is a positive one, but it should be turning around by now.
The most positive thing, I think personally, that we've accomplished since being in government is the raising of the lowest rate of tax threshold. We're effectively subsidising taxation on the poorest people, poorest wage earners in the country. The desire is to keep bringing that bottom level up and up and up and up. And
we've increased VAT.
We have. That's a problem. And there's, I mean, but at least progressive, no?
No, it's not. VAT is a regressive tax. So.
Sorry, not VAT, but the two taken together.
Oh, yeah, I mean, I'm just saying that the overall effect of what's happened is not negative. It's just neutral, because by increasing VAT, poor people pay more VAT than rich people, because they buy more things that are, they buy more stuff.
Actually, no, VAT is no VAT on food. There's all the basic
All sales taxes are regressive. They basically fall heavier on the poor than on the wealthy. Income tax is more progressive. And I do welcome what you've done with taking those poor people out of tax. And let's not have a political football here. Let's have a competition between the Liberal Democrats and the Labour Party to do the best we can for the poorest in the society. That's the kind of competition I want to see.
Absolutely.
OK, let's go on now to discuss the phone hacking scandal. And this week we've seen the end, announcement anyway, of the end of the News of the World. This is a long-running paper bought in the 1980s by Rupert Murdoch. But I think there's been a lot of attention, certainly in David Cameron's speech, which we'll hear a little bit from in a minute, this morning, about blaming journalism generally for this. One of the things which seems to have almost been left by the sidelines is the complete failure of the Metropolitan Police to act on some very serious evidence over the last 5 or 6 years that criminal activity was going on, and to sort of just allow one test case about a royal reporter to go through, and the rest of the evidence was sort of buried in a filing cabinet in Scotland Yard. Anyway, Andy Davis at Channel 4 News last night looked at the police's role in the phone hacking scandal.
The sale of police information can have devastating consequences for those whose details are passed on. In 2003, a case unfolded involving a young woman who went to the police to report a violent sexual assault. She had been attacked by a minor celebrity.
I was told if I pressed charges against this man, I'd have lifelong anonymity, and that meant that my name would never be released in connection with the case, and certainly never be printed or broadcast. If it was printed or broadcast, then the people who were responsible would go to prison.
The Crown Prosecution Service eventually dropped the case. The victim's identity should still have been protected, but Sam found herself hounded by reporters.
The press seemed to know everything about me. Certainly my name had been leaked, certainly my name.
They knew where I lived. They knew where my mum lived. They knew where I went to school. They were knocking on my neighbour's doors, shouting through my letterbox, shouting sums of money through my letterbox, trying to get me to sell my story.
It was clear that someone had breached Sam's anonymity order, and details that appeared in the News of the World seemed to point to one source.
There is no way that that News of the World journalist could have got the information about me unless it was given by the police. It could only have come from my statement. Somebody had read my statement. They quoted me verbatim. It had to come from my statement or from my filmed interview.
It's contempt of court to breach an anonymity order, as it is to leak details of a witness statement. Sam's name was also handed to the News of the World's investigator, Glenn Mulcair, and several attempts were subsequently made to hack into her phone.
The whole thing was quite shocking.
So, pretty harrowing story there, Guy Portney, Lib Dem councillor. And what are your thoughts about the whole phone hacking scandal? Do you think it's right that it's been dominating the news this week, or do you think it's been a bit of a blown up story? And what are your thoughts about the whole sort of relationship between the press and the police in this case?
I have two big concerns today as relates to the closure of the News of the World. And one is that we must make absolutely sure that, you'll never hear me say this again, I wouldn't have thought, that we don't see corporate responsibility applied to the News of the World on this. It is possible to find out who these people were and who they're working for now, and the full extent of the criminal justice system should be brought to bear on them. It's going to be no good shutting down an organisation when the vast majority of people working there weren't working there at the time. We know who the people who were culpable at the top were at the time, and I'm glad to see the police are investigating them.
Martin, what about you? Your thoughts on the phone hacking?
Well, I mean, obviously, I mean, I suspected that this was going on all along. I'm not at all surprised by any of this. I think when we're talking about journalism and good and bad journalism, The Guardian have pursued this whole thing like terriers all the way. Mm. All the way. And that is investigative journalism. And hopefully they'll bring down the whole News International empire. Murdoch nearly went bust 20 years ago, and he could go bust again. You know, he could be worth zero if we hit him hard enough.
Well, one of the things in that Channel 4 news report last night was that they secretly filmed Glenn Mulcair at his front door. This is the private investigator that had actually been doing the phone hacking. I'm not sure if you saw it. But he then actually said on a hidden camera on film that there was actually a committee that was making the decisions at the News of the World, at News International, about who was going to get hacked. So that's another bit of a revelation. So all these stories about, oh, it was just like one journalist...
Rebecca Wade seems to be covered in Teflon, doesn't he? Doesn't she? You know, what I sort of referred to earlier as ethics girl, Rebecca Wade.
Well, Simon Hughes, earlier this week, Simon Hughes from Lib Dems and Jeremy Paxman discussed this issue as well on Newsnight, and they were specifically looking at the idea of a proper public inquiry, which would be able to subpoena witnesses, including Rebecca Wade.
What on earth is a public inquiry going to achieve? I mean, the press have been drinking in what Mellor called the last chance saloon for 20 years now.
Well, the answer is what a public inquiry can do. Well, firstly, you have to choose somebody who is entirely separate from all the sorts of organisations, and that does mean a judge. And some colleagues were making the point it means a judge who's not a member of a Masonic lodge, not a member of the Gulf... No, I mean, it's a serious point. Who is actually not part of the network of people where police chief officers and police officers and so on actually need somebody who can then call for evidence, who can assist people answer, and who has entire independence and reputation. Now, that has to be the way forward. And I think it's only a question now of how you negotiate the terms of reference for that inquiry and then separately the separate inquiry to do with the police.
Now, David Cameron, in his press conference this morning, announced that there will be a public inquiry, but not until the police investigation, the resumed police investigation, Mark 2, into phone hacking, has finished. Do you think that's good enough? Guy, are you happy with that?
You don't want to endanger prosecutions by pushing this forward too fast. We've got to let the police do their job. My one concern, as I say, is if the News of the World is being shut down now, how much evidence we might be losing whilst that organisation's being put to bed. But you don't want to endanger those prosecutions going forward.
One of the other problems, of course, with shutting down the News of the World is it means that Rupert Murdoch has less titles, and so the cross-media ownership rules are actually easier for him. But Martin, well, what about that specific point on the judicial inquiry there?
I think that is right. In principle, you want to have people prosecuted rather than have an inquiry which is just hot air. On the other hand, there is a serious question about who will carry out that inquiry when the Metropolitan Police have been shown to be completely compromised. It makes you wish that the RUC still existed to come in here and have a look at it, doesn't it?
So David Cameron gave a press conference this morning on the issue, and by far the most questions were directed at him about his rather dubious choice of Andy Coulson to run his election campaign and be his right-hand man as regards press relations. So let's have a little listen to one of the extracts from that now.
I made a decision. I gave an individual a second chance. He carried out his job well. He wasn't criticised the way he did his job. He resigned all over again. That was the decision he came to. I know that. That's the decision I took. That's the responsibility I have. People will make their judgments. I think it's very different, frankly, from taking money for tobacco advertising or starting a war or whatever. I mean, I think it is different, but people have to decide. You know, I'm responsible for everything, the decisions I take, the people I employ, the government I run. The buck stops right here, and I take full responsibility for every single thing I do, and people will have to reach their own conclusions. Was it right to give someone a second chance? Was that a good decision? Was that a bad? People will decide. All I can do is explain why I did what I did, how he worked for me, the job that he did, and the fact that he's not working here, has resigned, as it were, all over again.
That was David Cameron speaking earlier today about his former press secretary, Andy Coulson. He's saying there, Guy, that he takes full responsibility. Does that mean he takes full responsibility for any possible involvement Andy had with hacking the phones of dead soldiers and their relatives and the 7/7 victims and their relatives?
Well, Cameron can take full responsibility for hiring someone with, well, I would imagine the Prime Minister would say that he had no way of knowing. No, he can take responsibility for hiring Andy Coulson, given the information that he had at his disposal. He can't take responsibility for what Andy Coulson had done prior to that, no.
Martin, what about this comment he made there about it's not like tobacco ads or starting a war? This is a bit of funny.
He sounded in very Blair mode there, didn't he? I mean, I've taken the decision and I thought I was right at the time. Yes, indeed, but was it the right decision? Frankly, a lot of the political class in this country and elsewhere are criminals. David Cameron might be in the frame as a criminal, not necessarily over this, but over other things. Berlusconi this week, he's still the Prime Minister of Italy, the richest man in the country. He tried to pass a law through Parliament, which actually led to... There was a tiny little sub-clause in this huge law, which meant that he didn't have to pay back somebody he owed 200 grand to. And it was taken out by the lawyers at the very last minute. So he's still up to little tricks. Still up to little tricks. Oh, well, you spotted that one, never mind. Here I am, still the Prime Minister. Now, when Berlusconi falls, he's not just going to fall politically, he's going to go to prison. And you know what? That could easily happen to politicians in the US and Britain, because they are all in it. And when we catch them out, they are going to prison. All of them.
Martin, it's a bit of a strong thing to say that David Cameron could be a criminal. You could be a criminal.
Indeed I could, but I don't have the scope to do things that he's done.
What's the sort of thing that you think maybe he's
done? We are getting whispers. I will say no more than that about things that he's been involved in the past. Many of these people are super wealthy people. They hang around with other super wealthy people. Many of these people are criminals. And a lot of their criminality is to do with fixing things in the legal system, making sure that the political atmosphere is right, making sure that certain laws are passed and other laws are not. The Congress people in the US, their shares, on average, do 10% better than everybody else's. And you know why? Because they're all insider traders. They know very well what legislation's coming up. And they have a word with their brokers and say, oh, I think you better start buying some of those stocks or selling some of those stocks, because we know what's coming down the line. That's insider trading. It's all illegal. During the savings and loan scandal in the 1980s, 3,500 US executives were sent to prison. Thus far, we've sent one person to prison, Madoff. But there's thousands of people out there who actually need to go to a proper prison, not to be fined for fraud, because that doesn't deter a fraudster. Being fined 10% of what you've stolen is not a punishment. The only punishment is to be everything to be taken off you, and you are sent to prison, possibly for life, if you've been involved with major drug dealing or murder, as many American politicians have been. Now, this may sound strong, but when the banks collapse, as they will before the end of the year, people are going to get angrier and angrier about this. And I'm shouting a bit on this this radio now, because I want to give a warning to the wealthy classes of this country and every country. If you are involved in anything illegal, we are going to harass you mercilessly. That is all.
And who is going to do the harassing, Martin?
Well, it's going to be the police force, Martin, isn't it? I talked earlier about the RUC. We don't have the RUC anymore. We have the Police Service of Northern Ireland, which is there to serve the whole community. And we need to get some provincial police forces in to have a look at the big boys and see how much they've been up to and whether they've been doing their job properly. Okay, sorry, well, I'm losing my temper, but I'm angry about this.
There certainly does seem to be a problem with the Metropolitan Police. In this initial investigation, and also David Cameron is very, very close to the Murdoch Empire, quite clearly. Having sort of cozy
at Christmas dinner with Rebecca Way, didn't he?
Having cozy chats between his culture secretary and James Murdoch, for example, which get found
this
out.
This Sky B thing needs to be knocked on the head right now, doesn't it?
Well, they were due to announce today, Guy. I'm not sure if you knew this, that the result of whether Rupert Murdoch was going to be able to fully take over Sky B, but that's now apparently been put off for another 3 months, hopefully until this storm blows over. But it seems that this is not going away, this particular story. But one thing I'd just like to do, sort of round it up, is to go to Dennis Potter, who's a local writer, a playwright, he had some very interesting comments just before he died, back in the 1990s, to make about Rupert Murdoch.
One of the favourite fantasy plots of a writer is a character's told, you've got 3 months to live, which is what I was told. Who would you kill? I call my cancer, the main one, the pancreas one, I call it Rupert, so I can get close to it, because that man, Murdoch, is the one who, if I had the time, in fact, I've got too much writing to do and I haven't got the energy, but I would shoot the bugger if I could. There is no one person more responsible for the pollution of what was already a fairly polluted press. And the pollution of the British press is an important part of the pollution of British political life.
That was Dennis Potter there, speaking about 12 years ago or so, just before he died, about his cancer and how he called his pancreatic cancer Rupert. Now, another announcement this week at Prime Minister's Questions, we had some questions about the awarding of a contract to manufacture trains, not to Bombardier, who are based here in Britain, Derby, but to Siemens, a German company. And before we have a clip from Prime Minister's Questions, Guy, can you tell me why it makes sense to award such an important infrastructure contract, the government that chooses this, paid for by our taxes, to a German company, not to a British company? Because it's going to mean actually a massive, massive cost, with various hundreds, if not thousands, of people being made redundant.
Gutted about it, absolutely gutted about it. We've got one government implementing it that, you know, my party's involved with, based on terms of reference set by a previous government that set those terms of reference up. As my understanding of it is that it was simply impossible to change those terms of reference. I think we need to start looking at the way that other governments do their procurement in terms of this. This is about necessary efficiencies. It's a perfectly plausible, logical market argument as to why those trains should have been made in Britain. Gutted.
Martin?
I think the terms of reference were put in place by New Labour upon the usual British principle of cheap and cheerful. You know, we'll just go for the cheapest. You know, the people are going to do it for the cheapest. And that's New Labour for you all over. But the terms of reference could have been changed by the new minister, but he chose not to. So they're all culpable. New Labour are culpable for this free market nonsense. But then, of course, the Liberal Conservative coalition are also in hock to free market nonsense. There's been free market nonsense. The Germans, of course, would never allow such a thing to happen in Germany. They know how the EU procurement system works, and there are various dodges you can use to make sure that you give your contracts to your own people. They always use those dodges. We do not. We always go for the cheapest option, and that's been the philosophy in Britain, that the cheapest will be the best in the long run. But it's not true. We've not had an industrial policy in this country for donkey's years. Do you know what they've got in Norway? An industrial policy. That's why their manufacturing industry is growing, and ours has disappeared. And that's because they believe in economic planning, which we've given up on years ago, and just allow the sharks to do whatever they want.
On Question Time last night, Hugh Grant was saying that actually this is dreadful for morale.
dreadful for morale of the government, I suspect.
Well, for the nation as a whole, to see, you know, more and more people being thrown onto the dole, and also great manufacturing skills just going to waste.
Well, it's not quite true. I mean, Siemens do, in fact, manufacture some things in this country, and Bombardier isn't a British company, it's just based here. So there will be some jobs from Siemens in the northeast. Yeah. But nevertheless, you see, in Germany, they would look at this and say, look, we want to keep an industrial base, because it's not just economies of scale, as you were talking about earlier, Guy, it's also economies of scope. If you stop manufacturing trains, you will get out of that game for good. And if you don't manufacture some trains, and this is true even for sub-Saharan Africa, you want to manufacture your own trains, even if it's a bit more expensive, so that you know how to manufacture trains, so that you can then move up the value scale, yeah, as the Japanese did. They started off with textiles and agriculture. And when they first started making electronics in the 1950s, the Americans laughed at them and said, you'll never compete with us in electronics. You're going to lose money hand over fist, but if you want to waste your money on it, off you go. The Japanese wasted loads of money on it, and then, of course, they took over the electronics industry and moved on from there. They know how to make plans.
Well, one article on it I've discovered, it was by Terry Murden. His headline was, Nation Which Invented Trains Singles the End of the Line. And at Prime Minister's Questions, Labour MP Margaret Beckett had this to say.
This is Margaret Beckett.
Is the Prime Minister aware that when yesterday Bombardier had to announce the redundancy, among others, of skilled engineers and designers, the company made public for the first time that they had offered to establish a new academy in this country for the design and manufacture of cars for the next generation of high-speed trains for this country and across the world, a global centre of excellence, more jobs and jobs with even higher skills? He won't have had time to familiarise himself with the detail of that, but will he undertake to look into it with care to give substance to the commitment he made in my constituency to British manufacturing?
I will look very carefully at what the Right Honourable Lady has said about this issue, but let me just say this, because obviously I want to see more British jobs in manufacturing, indeed as we are seeing across our country. But in the case of the Bombardier train contract, the procurement process was designed and initiated by the government of which she was a part. I have to say, we are bound by the criteria that they set out, and therefore we have to continue with the decision that's been made according to that criteria. Now, separately, we are setting out to ask the question, what more can we do within the current rules to make sure we boost manufacturing in our country and not have situations like this in the future?
But Guy Pulteney, Lib Dem Council, this is all words. He's saying, what can we do to boost manufacturing? And with the one hand, on the other hand, he's saying, well, this massive piece of manufacturing industry, and I'm sure people who were involved in the Keynsham chocolate factory, Cadbury's, going out of the country too, we'll be seeing, well, this is happening, it's not just here happening around here, it's happening all over the place. Our manufacturing base is just going abroad.
We're going to specialise as I was saying to Martin earlier, we've got to specialise in high tech. That's where the future is. That's something that we will be able to sell not only to our own government but around the world. It's making sure that we have that flexibility built into our economy. It's why I'm so proud that we have not one but two phenomenal engineering schools in this region. Why we have companies like Airbus operating very close to Bristol, why we have companies like Garrett Hassan doing very innovative things with wind power. As I say again, it's one of the reasons we're very well placed to come out of this recession.
And as Cameron pointed out there, Martin, it was Labour that set this whole contract up. So actually, at the end of the day, it's Labour's fault.
That's a fair point, because Labour, of course, New Labour, were enthralled to this free market ideology as much as the current government. Now, in actual fact, the current government could have changed the terms of reference if they wanted to, so Cameron is being disingenuous there. I would also add about manufacturing. Our manufacturing is a lot of it geared, like in Bristol, to military industry. That's just about all we've got left. The US has an industrial policy by the back door. It's called the Pentagon. Yeah, but of course in Germany they actually have an industrial policy, and they've always had an industrial policy. We don't believe in industrial policy. The market will do it, and I think that philosophy has got to go. But of course also you can't just copy other nations' activities, especially if you've been out of the game for 30 years. Britain really has now begun to specialise in cultural industries because everybody speaks our language. I mean, Bristol, as you know, creative industries is a major thing here.
Absolutely.
And we're never going to be the manufacturing power we were. We could have been if we'd carried on doing things sensibly, but we stopped doing sensible things years ago, and you can't then come back to the game 30 years out of the game and get back into it easily.
You have to specialise in innovation.
Yeah, but those become niche markets of the kind that you were talking about earlier. Yeah. The problem is that the mass marketing has gone elsewhere, and in a way that's likely to happen. But of course the success of countries like South Korea and China doesn't have to be a problem for us. If there's general increased production of everybody, then with more stuff to distribute. The problem is the macroeconomic policy being pursued is going to lead to a depression, and no manufacturing industry will survive that. And we've got to get the macroeconomic policy back on track, otherwise we're going to hit the wall. Well, we're going to hit the wall anyway.
Now, we've just heard about Airbus, but there's also a public meeting taking place later this evening at 7 o'clock, actually, on the future of Filton Airfield near Bristol. In April, BAE Systems, which owns the site, said it would close it at the end of 2012, following a review of its commercial and economic viability. Up to 5,000 homes can be built on the site, but Labour councillors from Filton Town Council want the land to be used for the aviation industry. The meeting's to be held at Filton Sports and Leisure Centre at, and it says here, 1900 BST, sounds a little bit sort of almost military or aviation-like that time, at 7 o'clock. And also there are plans to keep the Concorde Museum on the airfield site rather than relocate it to Cribbs Causeway. Doesn't sound like the future's great for the Filton Airfield guy, does it? And for, potential for continuing manufacturing high-tech aviation stuff up there.
No, I mean, it's a case of rationalising what you do with each space. I mean, one of the things that I would hope would come out of this is if, as I suspect it is, this is employment land, whatever they do on this, if it's more financially viable, if you end up getting a load of houses and shops, and let's face it, we do need more houses and we do need more jobs for people, I would also expect what's called a Section 106 contribution, a substantial Section 106 contribution to mitigate for the loss of that employment space.
Well, let's hope that South Gloucestershire Council managed to squeeze that out of these housing developers. But anyway, Martin, what about this whole thing about Filton closing? Because it's actually a very historic site, isn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, you can't be. I mean, we closed down the medieval harbour because it's no longer useful. I mean, we have Avonmouth instead. I mean, ultimately, airfields, you might want to keep them for historical reasons like Battle of Britain airfields or whatever, but the decision to use this space in one way rather than another is a practical decision. What worries me about the manufacturing at BAE and Filton is its military industry, which isn't of course the market at all. It's all final government consumption.
Well, actually,
so we talk about BAE as a private company.
Airbus.
Most of their contracts are with the government.
Airbus
to produce,
isn't. Rolls-Royce is also a large part of civil
well I know but I mean make. But underpinning all of this is massive government contracts for missiles, bombs and all the rest of it. Now that maybe we do need a military, but let's pretend that this is the free market. It's not the free market at all. The Pentagon isn't the free market. It's American taxpayers' money being lavished around on expensive kit, which puts a lot of money in some people's pockets. And it's actually a rather inefficient way to create jobs. If you were to create nursery schools, you'd create hundreds of jobs with the same money.
Okay, we must end this lottery of elderly care. This was in Wednesday's Evening Post. A postcode lottery in care for elderly people needs to be scrapped, according to a Landrat report. The Government Commission review demanded a new test to tackle the unfairness of some town halls, helping pensioners unable to wash, cook or shop for themselves while others refuse. Currently, Bristol, South Gloucestershire and North Somerset all fund care for people with substantial or greater need. But in other parts of the country, including Kent and many parts of the North West and Yorkshire, funding is offered to people with moderate need. So why is it, Guy, that here in Bristol you have to have substantial need to get any help from the government, but in many other parts of the country you only need to have moderate need to get that help? It is a postcode lottery, isn't it?
It's down to local democracy, I'm afraid. I mean, one of the things looking at it, when I first saw Kent, my immediate reaction was, oh, well, these are councils with more money to do this.
Yeah, but Yorkshire's in there too, isn't it?
Northwest Yorkshire isn't.
Northwest Yorkshire is relatively prosperous, isn't it?
This is North Yorkshire, sort of Harrogate, or places like
that's
that.
It's not Sheffield.
So why is it that we're getting now is we're getting certain almost like ghettoisation of certain parts of the country where there's quite a lot of poor people living there? Basically, the council services are crumbling.
This is a problem with the way that government allocates its local government grants to local authorities. It's simply. One of the reasons I'm so glad we've just had a census is that part of it will go some way to addressing this balance.
Yeah, I mean, I I'll bring up Norway. In Britain, every year, thousands of our pensioners die because they won't heat their homes properly and they can't afford to heat their homes. Norway, which has a much tougher climate than Britain, has hardly any deaths from hypothermia in the winter because they're properly organised. And Norway's only a small country, so they don't decentralise the decisions too much. There's only 3 million people. But, I mean, what they make sure of is if you are a Norwegian citizen, you are looked after. But, of course, they manage their economy very well, and the Statoil, which is their main oil industry, all of the profits from that go into the government's coffers, not into private hands. And, of course, that gives you a huge resource to provide things for elderly people. All of our North Sea oil money went off to Texas and has been used for other purposes because we believe in the free market. Load of rubbish.
The only trouble is, of course, it's a little bit cold up there. Right, our final story. Environment Agency meeting on Hinkley Point contamination. Officials from the Environment Agency have met with local councillors and officers, representatives of Green Audit and Stop Hinkley at Rivers House in Bridgewater at the end of last weekend, to discuss the allegations of radioactive contamination at the site earmarked at Hinkley Point. Now, Guy Portney from the Lib Dems, they're still talking, aren't they, about building these two new nuclear power stations near us, and you have the Energy Secretary Chris Hoon, who I think was they were some silly allegation against his something to do with his driving licence. Seems he's under a little bit of pressure from the press. But what's your thoughts on energy policy? Should we have these two power stations?
I would be lying if I pretended I knew a lot about this. My own feeling on nuclear is always that we've always been an anti-nuclear party.
Okay, that'll have to do, I'm afraid. That's all for this hour. Thanks to this week's guest. That was Lib Dem Cabinet Member for Neighbourhoods and Lockleys Councillor Guy Portney. After the news, the day after the sixth anniversary of the 7/7 London bombings, a senior police intelligence analyst who believes the four alleged bombers didn't do it.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Britain